in it, and to offer our worship and thanks to you. Help us to appreciate each and every of our days, and all of the blessings that you put in them. Help us to learn to use each appropriately and in ways that bring honor and glory to you. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen.
Amen. All right, Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We've been going at a pretty good clip for the last couple weeks, doing two chapters at a time. I think we're going to just slow down and do what we can with 7 and then call it a night. So if you would turn there in your Old Testaments, we will read the first 15 verses and then we'll stop and talk about it. So can I get a volunteer to do 1 through 15? There you go. Thank you. About to draft somebody. Thank you for volunteering.
A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death and the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. There is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing.
All right. Thank you, Luke.
So, we've talked about this a little bit before. What the preacher is doing in this book is he's talking about the cycle of life that all of life goes through. We go through it. But, you know, the water cycle goes through it, the wind goes through it, everything kind of runs over and over in a circle. And so his material has been kind of doing that as well. He's talking about things and then he'll bring them up again later. And so he's been telling us there's plenty of enjoyment to be had in life. If you have money, there's some pleasure in that. You can do a lot with that. When you have health, you have relationships, you have work. All those things can be good in their place, but nothing under the sun is going to fully, completely give us satisfaction. And so he's done different things to teach us that. And remember back in chapter 1, chapter 2, we had a lot of discourses. We had a lot of him just narrating the experiences of his life and telling us, hey, I did this, and I built that, and I had these relationships. And here's my conclusion about all that. Sometimes in the book, you'll see poetry. Chapter 3 is a good example of that. For everything, there's a season, a time for every matter under heaven, a time for this, a time for that. It's very poetic. And then sometimes in the book, you're going to have sections that read a lot like the book of Proverbs. And that's not surprising, especially if Solomon is the preacher here. But also, if you skip over to chapter 12, it's interesting that as the book closes, chapter 12, verse 9 says, besides being wise, here's what the preacher did. He also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. And so you can go to the book of Proverbs and get a whole lot more of that from Solomon. But this chapter, in chapter 7, A lot of this first part of the chapter reads in a very proverbial kind of way. And so that's what he's going to do to try to talk about wisdom and foolishness here. And he's gonna do a lot of comparing. There's a lot of comparison. One thing is better than another thing. So verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, fancy perfume, and the day of death than the day of birth. I think that's an interesting way of talking about this. There's nothing wrong with ointment. There's nothing wrong with perfume, obviously. But perfume is just superficial. It's just something that you put on top of your body, and it's temporary, and then it goes away. But what about a good character? Like that, if that's inside of you, if that's your person, that's something that lasts. That's something that has substance to it. And so if you don't have a good character, really there's no amount of perfume that you can put on that'll mask that. But if you do have a good name, then dying and finishing your race well is better than birth. Because when you're born, I mean, that's an exciting time, but birth just has a lot of unlived life ahead of it. There's a lot of potential with you know, a human life at the point of birth. But if somebody has lived all of their years now, and now they're at the end of their journey, and they have made good choices, and they have allowed Jesus to come into their heart and change them, then that the day of death is glorious. Because you know where they are, and they're in the presence of Jesus. So we have that perspective as Christians. But even during this Old Testament time, they had some sense of that too. Verses 2 through 4 are really interesting too. Whenever I preach funerals, verse 2 is usually a verse that I will bring into the sermon. It's better, here's a comparison again, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. It's better to go to a funeral than it is to a party. Now, a party is a lot more fun. There's usually a lot more laughter at a party, a lot more of a lot of things. But with a funeral, why is a funeral better than a party? What does he say about that? What's the cause of the... Yeah, a funeral can teach you things that a party usually is not going to teach you. When I'm sitting around a table playing Ticket to Ride, I'm not thinking a lot of deep thoughts about my existence and what my purpose for being here. I'm just having fun putting trains on the table. But he said, you know, the living need to take something to heart. This is the end of all mankind. We need to be thoughtful about that, not wallow in sorrow. But if we have a contemplative life, I think verse 3 is saying, then that will lead to a good place. It will push us in a good direction. Adversity is better for our souls than pleasure is. And I think this reminds us of other places too. Like, you remember the one psalm that we have that Moses wrote? Remember Psalm 90? He wrote in Psalm 90, verse 12, teach us to number our days, so that we can gain a heart of wisdom. Psalm 39, verse 4, David said, Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days. Why? So that I may know how frail I am. So there's a good purpose for all of that. And verse 4 kind of goes along with this. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. A fool is not going to take his life seriously. He's not going to learn any lessons, but the wise do. Thoughts or comments so far, down through 4? You want to add anything? Yeah.
Overall, it seems to be saying that the end of vanity is a lot better than starting into vanity. And what needs to be thought about is preparing for end of vanity, that so many of us prepare in a lot of vain ways to head into more vanity.
Yeah.
And that's a waste of preparation and news.
Yeah. Amen. Good. Anybody else?
Just
So that it has that potential to create good things in us. We got to make sure that we approach adversity in the right kind of way, though. You remember the Israelites went through plenty of days of tough times, and they didn't really learn anything. A lot of them didn't learn anything from that. So if we approach it with complaining and discontentment instead of what he's talking about here, we're going to be in trouble, but it certainly has that potential. Good. Anybody else? All right, so notice 5 and 6. 5 and 6 is talking about how, kind of like funerals and death and sorrow, it's not a lot of fun to be in a position where you come into some rebuke. Somebody pulls you aside and says, that wasn't well done. You need to change something about your life. It's never fun to be told that, but if you are corrected by somebody who actually understands what they're talking about and they have some biblical experience with the words of God and they're giving those to you, that can be a wonderful training moment. That can be such a valuable experience. Because remember what Jesus said in Luke 6:26, "Woe to you when all people speak well of you." If everybody all the time is just singing your praises, oh, everything you do is wonderful, 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 wonderful. I mean, how are you going to learn from that? Because we all know deep down, not everything we do or say is wonderful. We need people to come and say, yeah, that needs help. Now, if that's the only thing that they're doing, then we need to pull it in the opposite direction a little bit. But we all need correction. You remember Proverbs 27, verse 6? Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And that was written a whole lot, like a long time before Judas came into the picture. But you remember in the garden, that's exactly what Judas does. He kisses his Lord, even though he's got a heart of blackness, because he's about to deliver his Lord over to the people who would take him to the cross. So faithful are the wounds of a friend. We need friends like that. But by contrast, notice how he talks about the Song of Fools in verse 5, in verse 6. It's kind of an interesting picture in verse 6. As the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. So when you're setting a fire, maybe some of you have done this, you got some brambles, you got some dried things that don't have a lot of substance to them. You throw them in the fire, and there's a crackle, there's a pop, there's a lot of noise. Maybe the fire goes whoosh, and there's a lot to be seen there, but it doesn't last. It burns up, and then that's it, as opposed to putting a big honking log on the fire. Now, that's gonna give you some heat for a while. So that's what listening to fools is like. There's nothing of substance to them, to their laughter. They don't take life or you seriously. And so we need to appreciate what we can learn from correction, even when the person who is correcting you isn't doing a very good job of it. You ever had that happen before? Somebody comes to you and they're like, "That you didn't do that very well," and you can't really tell that they love you or appreciate you. There's even something to be learned from those situations. I was reading about a story to prepare for this, where this younger preacher was just called out. I mean, somebody just smacked him in the face verbally and just said, "You're a liar," for whatever thing he said. And so he went to an older preacher to get advice. And the older preacher looked at him and said, "Well, are you? Like, I mean, you need to think of what you said, even though you sure didn't appreciate that and the way that he came at you. We need to take what we can learn from criticism, but especially from a friend, especially from someone who's trying to help us. There's a lot to be learned from that. 7 through 9, look at verses 7 through 9, where he's talking about, "Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, a bribe corrupts the heart,
Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. The patient in spirit, better than the proud in spirit. Again, contrast here. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. So there are lots of pressures, lots of temptations under the sun. And what he's talking about at the beginning with the bribery business, there's a lot of opportunities that you and I have to cut corners, right? To not be as faithful, as steadfast as we know that we should be. We have to guard against that and not become spiritually dull or crazy. driving the wise into madness, corrupting the heart, verse 7. That needs to not be in us. We need to look down our path far enough to be able to see what the outcome is in terms of where we're going, where it's all leading. Verse 9, I think, reminds us of Ephesians 4:26. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. You know, yes, is it possible to be godly and have anger at the same time? Yes, because Ephesians also says, be angry and do not sin. But I think you know as well as I do that if anger is in us for any length of time, that can quickly turn selfish. It can quickly turn ungodly. And so be very careful to become angry. And then even when you are, there's a lot that needs to be guarded against with that. Verse 10 is an interesting verse. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it's not from wisdom that you ask this. You ever heard somebody who's on the older end of the spectrum say, man, back in my day, you know, hamburgers were 5 cents, and now they're, you know, $50 going through McDonald's. Or, you know, maybe that's a trivial thing. But sometimes it's even something more of substance. You know, back in my day, people were a lot better on the street, you know, meeting somebody than they are now in this way or this way. But he's pointing out, you know, it's really, that's not helpful. That's not a wise thing to say. You know, we have to, even though we might think, man, our country or our environment, our community is going to the dogs. I mean, hasn't the entire world always been going to the dogs? No matter what time period you look at, whether it's the 50s or the 60s or the 1700s or the 1400s, every time of world history under the sun has had things that you could criticize and say, man, that's really bad. And sometimes it's worse than others, yes. But the job of God's people is to live in this broken world, wherever we're at, whatever the time period is, whatever's going on in the world, whether it's good or bad, we live here and we do His will and we trust and submit to His plans, even though we can't understand everything that He's doing. We're going to serve God no matter what. And I think that leads into 11 through 15, the last section that Luke read. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. The protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, the advantage of knowledge, that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Think about the work of God. Who can make straight what he's made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider God's made one, he's made the other, so that man may not find out anything of what will be after him. And then he talks about his experiences a little bit in 15. There's a righteous man who sometimes perishes, even though he's doing the right thing. There's a wicked guy who is able to extend his life, even though he's doing wicked things and he's not commended by God. He lives a little bit longer sometimes. And so we can't always see or understand the purposes of God behind everything. You know, why is it that, for example, when you get to the book of Acts, James, the brother of John, gets cut off by Herod pretty early on in the book. But then his brother, John, outlives all of the apostles, lives to be an old man. And so how do you explain all of that? How do you understand what's going on with Job if you're on the ground with Job going through his trials. There's a lot of things in Bible history and maybe even our personal lives where we can look at and say, I don't get this. Why did this happen this way? It didn't have to happen that way. It's not how I would have done it if I'm God. But we have to understand that we don't see the big picture like he does. And so, yes, wisdom has some protection to it. Wisdom is a good thing to pursue. He keeps saying that over and over throughout the book, because he'll go these places where he'll say, you know, even if you got wisdom, you're going to die like the beasts do or something like that. But he's going to also have moments like this where he's going to say, wisdom is good. You should be wise. And so we got to trust and submit to his plans, even though we might not live long as an unrighteous neighbor or whatever the case may be. We're going to be blessed at the end of days after the vanity is over, because the vanity is only going to last so far for us. Comments or questions through verse 15? Okay. 16 through 24. Get that for us. Yeah, we'll get that, Brent. Thank you.
Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other. God will escape them all. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. There is not a just man under who does good and does not sin. Also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant's curse. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. All this I have proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from. As for that which was far off and exceedingly, who can find it?
Okay, thank you. So let's tackle 16 through 18. What is he talking about here? When he says, verse 16, be not overly righteous. Don't make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Verse 17, be not overly wicked. Neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Obviously, he can't be saying, we got to find a happy medium between being really, really good and really, really bad. There's got to be something in the middle we should shoot for. Obviously, he's not saying that, but what is he saying here? Anybody want to tackle that?
Excessively righteous could potentially be legalistic righteousness or seeking righteousness instead of just living righteously, finding, making the acquisition of knowledge and wisdom the end of it. And I likewise get it from the same direction on the wickedness part. Again, I don't believe everything we've been talking about, do be wise. Don't make your life that of seeking wisdom. Live your life with wisdom. Realizing, as he says in a few verses down, no one is perfect. And so that's
right.
Try not to seek that level of perfection, because that's certainly striving after.
Yeah, and I think the verse 20 is going to come into this discussion too, because it's right there in the context. I think verse 15, the verse right before this, helps us out with this too, where he says, there's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. I think what he's getting at there is, you know, our destiny under the sun can't be determined by the kind of character that we have. God does want us to be righteous. He does want us to have wisdom. He does want us to seek him. But sometimes righteous people die more quickly than wicked people do. Sometimes there's that kind of situation under the sun. And so if you try to live a life of perfect purity, you know, that's not going to automatically guarantee a life of peace and prosperity. And in the same way, and we can't, you know, if we go with the life of wickedness, that's for sure not going to give us satisfaction at all. But like, kind of like what Stephen was just saying, what verse 20 says is, even for the people who are trying to be righteous and please God, nobody is going to do that perfectly, which, by the way, this is setting up for the man who comes and does live a perfectly righteous life for us on our behalf. So instead, what should we do? We should fear God. Notice how he says, he camps on that in a lot of these passages, and he comes down on that in verse 18. It's good, you should take hold of this and not withhold your hand. So grab on tight and don't let go. You've got to fear God. And that's of course, what he's going to end with at the end of the book. The conclusion of the whole matter is that very idea. No matter what, whether you understand it or not, your life, whether you have good days or bad days, that's what you should hold on to. And so 19 through 24, building on those ideas, he's talking about wisdom, how it's a good thing, but we are insufficient to become all that we want to be in and of ourselves with using our own strength. Because, you know, notice what he says in 23 and 24. Sorry, 21 and 22. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself cursed others. We all understand the truth of those verses, how you get wind of the way that somebody else is talking about you. That's happened to me. I get really riled up about that, but then the next verse comes into play and you think, well, but haven't I just done the same thing either about them or about other people? So I have no right to get all self-righteous about that because I've stumbled, I've fallen. I'm verse 20, I'm trying to please God, but I'm one of these men on earth who doesn't have a perfect sinless record in my soul. So we'd like to be wise, but we struggle with things like 21 and 22. And so none of us, 23, 24, can say, I've got all the wisdom I need. I have made it. I have studied it all out. I've had all the experiences, and I'm there. Even the preacher, he kind of throws his hands up and says, well, I wanted to be wise, but I couldn't fully even get there. It was far from me. It's deep. It's very deep. You know, and I don't have a deep enough bucket to draw that out with. Who can find it out? So this is a humbling passage, I think, that really helps us with our attitudes in a lot of ways. Comments or questions down there through 24? Yes, sir.
In 18, do you think the two things that he's talking about there are two or still righteousness and wisdom?
But I'm open to other thoughts on that.
No, because that's what I think too, and I just wonder when you were saying that fear of God comes from the love of what?
Yeah.
Well, if we radically pursue righteousness to the detriment of wisdom, or if we radically pursue wisdom to the detriment of righteousness, I think that's the problem he's talking about, or the wrongness that will happen is one will suffer from the overemphasis of the other. But the person who fears God is listening to what God says about it, and just needs to hang on to both and give to God with both.
Yes.
Yeah, so fearing God stabilizes us and rights the ship and causes us to be where we need to be. Yeah, good. Other thoughts? Okay, let's finish up the chapter, 25 through 29. Could you read that, Steve?
Directed my mind to know, to investigate, to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. I discovered how bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Yet what I discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another. I am still seeking, but I have not found. I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, they sought out many devices.
Okay, so there's also some interesting verses in here as he closes. Starting with 25, notice how that sounds a lot like some earlier parts of the book, chapter 1, 17. It's basically that idea. I'm setting my mind to experiment and to do this and to do that and to search really hard to see if I can get my mind and my heart around this idea of wisdom and foolishness so he can warn people, guide his audience. And so verse 26, he's going to come back to something that, you know, he talks a lot about in the Proverbs. If you read the first 9 chapters of Proverbs, it's all about the lady wisdom or lady folly and the woman who can ensnare you and take you in because of her sexual advances and just wreck your life. And so he gets to that there in 26. Run away from her. She is snares and nets and fetters. She's going to catch you and lock you down, and nothing good is going to come from that. So run away from her. Keep in mind that, I mentioned this briefly before, I'm suspecting that Ecclesiastes is especially geared toward younger men because of chapter, or at least younger people. Chapter 12, remember, the way that starts out, verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. He, at least there, when you get to that point, he is directly talking to younger people who have a lot of them. So it's typically younger people that fall prey to the verse 26, what he's talking about here back in chapter 7. So he's warning about that. And notice, in his searching, in his investigating wisdom, he mentions what he has found and what he hasn't found. So verse 27, I've been searching, find the scheme of things. And so verse 28, he just says, I haven't really been impressed with anybody. I've looked at a lot of people, and I only found one man. And of those people, I didn't even find one woman. And if we're talking about Solomon, I mean, my side comment is, well, look where you were looking. You're looking at the princesses of these foreign countries, these pagan women, and yeah, you're not going to find a lot of women there. I mean, when I think about my personal experience, sometimes in local churches, I know a lot of really, really solid, godly women. And sometimes not as many solid, godly men. But be that as it may, this is his experience. But he's essentially saying, I haven't really found anybody, more or less, who is trying to serve God in the way that they should. So we all need a lot of grace, is what I take away from that. Verse 29, but here's what I have found. And he really camps on this, that when God made us, when he created us in his image, he made us in the right kind of way. He made us complete. He made us whole. He made man upright. But we have done a bunch of things that we shouldn't have done. We've made ourselves unwell. And so we all, Romans 3, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Whether you're a Jew or you're not a Jew, you're Gentile, we all need God's wisdom, God's help, God's grace. And it's rough to live under the sun sometimes, and we need his help in that. And he is helping us, and ultimately he's coming to bring us to a day where there's no more vanity anymore. So again, I'm going to hammer 1 Corinthians 15 again. In the Lord, your labor is not in vain. Even though we stumble through it sometimes we don't do it as well as we could, he's helping us along, and he's going to reward us someday. Thoughts or comments through the end of the chapter here, 29? Yeah.
He told us in verse 1 of chapter 1, he's king in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And when you think about the kind of people
who hang around
the king,
yeah.
And you think about the kind of motives that they have,
yeah.
You actually have much better odds as a common man to come out with finding a faithful friend or a good woman than what a leader has. The leaders, they don't find them. They're not looking in the right place. But this is what's approaching them, and they see how much folly is out there.
Yeah. They, for the most part, find a lot of sycophants and people who kiss up to them and say, oh, you're wonderful, whatever you want. And
not what you're really
after. Right. Right. Yeah. Which is what made Daniel so special in the court of the kings that he served. I mean, he served it to you straight. Here's what God said. You're going to get cut down. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. Anybody else?
I got a question, I guess, maybe in 26. Do you think that he is beginning to see if this in fact is Solomon, and he is maybe beginning to accumulate concubines and wives and those kinds of things? Do you think this is where this comes from, or is this prior to him finding all of this? I mean,
he says he's discovered.
He's discovered.
He's
in the midst. There's I have wondered so much about if this is Solomon, what's the time period of his writing this? Seems to be on the older end of the scale. I'd like to think that he repented. I'd like to think that he turned around and he saw the foolishness of what he's done, but we just don't. Don't know. Okay. No, right. It's one of those tantalizing little, maybes that are out there. Because Kings and Chronicles sure don't tell us that he repented of any of that. Good. Anybody else?
Well, how many extra expectations come along with those gifted women from all these foreign countries? They don't come free for that.
You're right.
He's just previously talked about
bribes. Oh, that's true.
Now what do we owe? What kind of favors are we going to have to return?
Yeah, that'll be one treaty, please.
Right.
Yeah.
Pharaoh's eyes aren't free.
No, they're not. Oh, indeed. Yeah, good point. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there a little bit early. But that's chapter 7. And we'll pick up there in 8, not next week, but the week following that. So I'll be at Normal next week, and Brent's going to lead the class or whatever it's going to be. And I think he said not going to do Ecclesiastes, going to do something else. So appreciate him for being willing to do that, and I'll look forward to catching chapter 8, chapter 9 with you next time we do this.